The Jodcast, Walking the Plank, with Liz Guzman, Libby Jones, Indy Leclerc, Ian McDonald, and Mark Perver. The Jodcast, March 2013, Extra Edition, a Plank Special. Hello and welcome to The Jodcast. I'm Indy and I'm joined today by fellow presenters Mark and Liz. Hi guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Today we're quite excited in the studio in anticipation of the new results from the Plank mission, which are being released after many months of secrecy within the corridors of JBCA.
Years of secrecy, I'd say.
Yeah, perhaps. Years. So yeah, Plank was launched in 2009, and since then people have been very, very secret about everything that is observing. So finally, it's going to be released. It's being released now.
If you're listening to this, then the results should be out. We're recording this the day before. But the reason everyone's so excited is that Planck is going to bring us the most accurate measurements ever taken of the cosmic microwave background, the radiation which sort of suffuses the universe. So there was COBE, and then there was WMAP, and now Planck is going to be the new standard for measurement of the cosmic microwave background.
So hopefully we'll have, from today or tomorrow onwards, a better picture of the cosmology of the universe. In the show this time, we talked to Dr. Paddy Leahy about some of today's Planck results, and your astronomical questions are answered by Dr. Ian McDonald. But first, before all that, Libby talked to Professor Richard Davies about the star of this show, the Planck instrument.
Joining me on the Jodcast today is Professor Richard Davies from the University of Manchester. Hello and welcome back to the Jodcast.
Hello, I'm pleased to be here.
The last time you talked to us on the Jodcast, Planck had just been launched. Can you fill us in a bit more about what you've been doing since then?
Yes, well, the fantastic thing is it all went up and worked. At the time of the launch, we had no idea whether the instrument was working because it wasn't switched on. It didn't get switched on for about another 20 days. And I was present at the data processing centre in Trieste. And when we switched our amplifiers on, there were 20 amplifiers altogether. And it took us 2 days to switch them on because we had to be in contact with the spacecraft when that happened. And that happens over a two-hour period every day. So it took us 4 hours to switch them all on. And it was very, very exciting. And when we last ran the amplifiers, had been in CSL, Centrale Spatiale Liège, in a big cryostat as big as my house, cooled down to 4 Kelvin. And so we knew the performance of all the amplifiers. And when we switched them on in space, I was astonished to find that even though they were now nearly a million miles from the Earth, every single one of them turned on with the currents and voltages within 1% of how they'd performed in the laboratory at Liège. And given what had happened to them, it was very exciting.
So with 1% of what you were testing, the performance was as expected in space?
So this was just the current through the transistors. At that stage, we hadn't actually measured the performance as radiometers. But I'm happy to say that they all worked. I must admit, I thought we might lose about 10%. If you just looked at other people having tried to build radiometers, that's about the sort of figure that had been achieved. In fact, all 20 worked. There are 8,000 bond wires that join the whole thing together, and it was built by our technician, Eddie Blackhurst. But Eddie didn't want to do the checking, which is quite right, so somebody had to check all these bond wires, and so it fell to me to check all 8,000 of them. And having checked all those, I thought, well, what's the chance of all those still working when it launched? Well, they did. It must say something about this space qualification. I think we had some luck as well. Let's be serious here.
Well, it seems like that was very successful with everything working as you expected. Can you tell us just a bit more in general about the instrument that you were helping design?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit more about the launcher start. What we didn't know is how accurately the Ariane rocket had managed to post Planck into its correct orbit. The Ariane rocket was responsible for it getting there. There were some small motors on Planck that then decelerated it to put it into the L2 orbit. But there was quite a margin for error as to how accurately it would do that. And so there was quite an amount of fuel on Planck that could be used if it was in the wrong place. It could correct and put it into the right place. In fact, the Ariane did a perfect job. It actually, we didn't know this at the time. We didn't learn for a few weeks that it had actually put it into a perfect orbit, which means that we've actually got enough propellant on Planck to run it for 20 years. We're not intending to run it for 20 years, but it's that good. But it has meant that we, even though HFI could only run for 2.5 years, and that was the design life, because it loses its helium-3 that's required to cool it down. The LFI, the low-frequency instrument, the one that I was involved with, is recyclable and could, in principle, last for a lot longer. And so far, we've been running for 4 years. So the nominal mission was only meant to be 1 year. So we've run it for 4 years. So those of you who know about observing time versus sensitivity, 4 times longer means you get double the sensitivity. So the performance of the LFI, we have things called requirements and goals. And the requirement is you have to promise to meet the requirement. That's the aim. And then if you're really, really lucky, you try and achieve the goals, which are actually considerably higher in sensitivity. And the good news is that Planck, the LFI, now has reached its goal, not only reached its requirements, but reached its goals. The HFI reached its goals almost immediately and has worked beautifully. So both cameras have performed fantastically. So the data we've got is really quite astounding. And I'll be showing it to all the scientists here in Manchester tomorrow as the press is released. But I can't talk about those actual cosmological results at this stage. But the performance of the machine is well published. And so I'm quite free to talk about any of that. Of course, we're absolutely overjoyed. I mean, I've worked on this machine for 18 years. I'm able to measure it by my son's age because I started working on it when he was born and he's 18 years old. So I'm able to get that right every year. I just have to remember my son's birthday.
And per year, how much of the sky does it map?
So it sees the whole sky every 6 months. So it's in an orbit called L2, which is 1 million miles away from the Earth. So it's 4 times further away than the moon. It used to touch me sometimes when I was handling the bits and pieces of the equipment to think, this thing's going 4 times further away than Neil Armstrong. it hadn't quite twigged that this was, it's a truly, truly amazing thing that it's going to, that it did.
And what type of objects is the low frequency array looking at?
So it's a survey instrument, and so as I say, within 6 months, we survey the whole sky. It's a heliocentric orbit. We rotate round the sun at the same rate as the Earth, the same angular rate. So if you imagine the line joining the sun and the Earth and Planck, that always remains in a straight line as the year continues. Planck itself is looking, it has the Earth and the moon and the sun behind it. It's looking in the cold direction. And so as the year progresses, so the spacecraft is looking at different regions of the sky. It's spinning, and so it is able to survey the whole of the sky every 6 months. So 4 years will actually complete 8 surveys.
And you said you have 20 more years' worth of fuel, but you won't run it for that long. How long do you envision it being run for?
This is a problem because it does cost quite a bit of money to run it, because it's just the manpower on the ground and running the data links, the communication with the spacecraft. It is quite expensive. And anyway, it has been agreed that we're running it for 4 years. 4 years actual observing. So that's like 4 years and 3 months, because we spent 3 months getting there and getting it all tuned up and working. Beyond that, nothing else is agreed. The thing that will probably limit it is a machine called the sorption cooler. This is the most expensive, miserable refrigerator you can imagine. It has a cooling power of 1 watt. It has no moving parts. It works just by heating and cooling, palladium metal, and the hydrogen comes out of the palladium when you heat it and goes into the palladium when it cools down. And in that way, you can make a compressor and also enable the gas to expand and contract. And this actually cost $40 million. And there are two of those on board, and they have a limited life. But the king is dead, long live the king. These things can be regenerated. What happens is the palladium metal decays and starts to become a powder. But if you heat it hot enough, it can regenerate into the proper metallic state again. This has been done on the ground, but it's never been done in space. So we are going to regenerate later this year. And we don't know how much life there will be left in it. Looking on the good side, we have got funding to run it for till August, which will make the end of the fourth year.
Now that the high-frequency ray is no longer working in counterpart with the low-frequency ray, do they have very different science goals that you can achieve?
Well, both instruments are surveying the sky. The low-frequency instrument works from 30 to nearly 100 gigahertz, and the high-frequency instrument works from 100 gigahertz to 857. The problem we have to observe the microwave background is to find regions where we can look where we don't see the foregrounds, the so-called emission from the galaxy. And these foregrounds come to a minimum around 70 gigs, 70 gigahertz. Above that, you get this thermal dust. On the 6 months date of the first survey, which is published, I'm sure many people of you have seen that, the white stuff is the 857 gigahertz. That's all thermal dust emission. At very low frequencies, we see radiation from the galaxy called synchrotron radiation and free radiation. And so we try and go for the region in between. But we need all the frequency channels so we can subtract these foregrounds out, which enables us to see the microwave background in great detail. But when you study these foregrounds, you have to study them in great detail to be able to subtract them out accurately. A lot of the processes for subtracting these things out are only good to about 30%, and we need significantly better than 0.1%.
Is this due to the sensitivity and resolution that Planck's been able to do, that you need this extra detail to get rid of the foregrounds?
Indeed. But what happens, of course, when you study something in such detail, you start getting interested in it for its own right. And this is an area where the University of Manchester, Jodrell Bank, JBCA, is leading the world. It really stems from the time of Rod Davies, who is still with us, and he's very much, he was the first co-I to the Planck project, and it was him who invited me to come and join in this project. Now, he's got an interest in galactic astronomy that goes back for some 65 years, so a very, very long period of time he's been interested. And I often joke that if you took Rod out into the galaxy and dropped him off, he'd find his way back, because he has a three-dimensional model of the galaxy in his head.
So some results already for Planck have already been published. Can you tell us some about these results?
Okay. Well, I've mentioned the synchrotron radiation at low frequency and the free thermal Bremsstrahlung, and I've mentioned thermal dust at high frequency. And so we all thought, great, we'll go and observe around 30, 40 gigahertz, which is where our LFI frequencies are. And would you believe, just when you thought it was safe to come out at night, we've discovered a new foreground. It's called anomalous dust. We call it anomalous dust because the pattern of it on the sky looks the same as the thermal dust. But it's too bright. It's at these low frequencies, the thermal dust has become very, very faint. And it's sort of 500 times brighter than the thermal dust.
So the thermal dust is very, very, very cold dust.
Yes, it is cold dust. That's right. So this anomalous dust, we think, must be associated with the dust. In fact, for a long time, we've wondered, and Rod has been very keen on this idea, that it might be spinning dust. So this is just like particles being in equilibrium with photons, picking up their energy, vibrating. So also, dust particles can spin. It's a remarkable thought that these little tiny dust grains, about the size of a naphthalene molecule, that's mothballs, for those of you who know about these things, these molecules have got 50 carbon atoms in, and with an infrared photon hitting them, they can spin at 30 gigahertz. And if these molecules, which naphthalene is, are asymmetric in their electron distribution, then when you spin such a molecule, it looks like a little oscillating dipole, and they radiate by electromagnetic radiation. And the spectrum that you get matches very well with the spectrum. And this is what Planck has done very nicely, and it is, this result is published. shown unequivocally that the spectrum really fits very, very well with the spinning dust.
That's a really cool discovery. So you also have a piece of Planck in your, well, a piece of design testing material for Planck. Can you tell us what you're holding and
yes.
what it does?
You must think I'm a little bit mad because I'm sat here with a wrist strap on connected to the mains, but in fact the wrist strap is merely, the mains is really connected to the earthing pad. So I'm handling what we call the qualification model. This was the last model we made before we built the bits that actually flew. So this is as close as we could get to the actual flight hardware. The transistors in here are so, the gates in them, the important parts are so tiny that the static carried by a human being, particularly on these nylon carpets we have in here, would blow the transistors up. So I have to earth myself before handling any of it. The structure is a three-dimensional, I call it the Rubik Cube. It was designed by Frank Winder. I was absolutely amazed at this thing when he showed me the design. I'll show you on the computer screen in a moment. And it all went together. I thought we'd have to make loads and loads of these models before we got something that actually assembled properly. In fact, it all fitted together and worked. It was hardly changed between this qualification model and the system that actually flew.
What job is this model designed to do?
Okay, so this is one of the 30 gigahertz front-end modules. It takes in two signals of the two polarizations from the horn, which then goes to an orthomode transition, producing the two polarizations. It also takes in two reference channels. We have to have a reference signal, and we use the body can of the HFI, which conveniently cools to 4.5 Kelvin. We'd rather have 2.7 Kelvin. We really want the same temperature as the microwave background as our reference signal, but 4.5 Kelvin is pretty close and turned out to be sufficiently close for us to get cancellation of what we call red noise, which is a problem that transistors have. It's a noise which increases the longer you wait. One of the problems that we get with 1/f noise is cleaners with the vacuum cleaners and air conditioning that comes on and goes off during the day and night time and is different at the weekends. Of course, all that sort of thing disappears once you're in space, and so the hardware all worked much better than when it was on the ground, when all the human beings were out of the way. And of course, none of us were fiddling with it as well. I think that helped.
And the engineering involved in that is very detailed. How many of these were on the spacecraft?
Okay, so we flew 5 of them, and we had a grant for £2.5 million. So in some sense, you could argue that each of them cost £500,000. And they were pretty well priceless to us because there wasn't sufficient time to build another one. Having built them all so carefully, what we did was put them we packaged them up and put them in the back of one of the Jodrell Bank vehicles and drove them down to Rutherford Appleton Labs and shook them to pieces. Well, we didn't shake them to pieces, we shook them violently. But the rule now, after Apollo 13, one of the things to come for Apollo 13, because they damaged Apollo 13, one of the tanks with the testing. They actually tested it to destruction, so when they tried to use it, it blew up. We all know the Apollo 13 accident. And they modified how you do testing now of flight hardware. And that is the actual flight hardware. You don't push it up to the same level as the rocket vibrations. You do it less. What they used to do was actually tested things without realizing it, virtually to destruction. But we had, it was still frightening. You couldn't be in the room when the vibrator was on because it would have blown your eardrums.
Wow.
We used to measure the radio performance of these pieces of equipment before we shook them, and then measure them after we'd shaken them, and we never saw any change whatsoever. The only thing we did see is we measured the vibration frequencies, so so-called eigenfrequencies, for those who are theoretically minded. And these eigenfrequencies just changed a little bit in the first few seconds. And because this is actually made of lots of different bits and pieces all screwed together, I think the bits and pieces just settled in slightly. There must have been microscopic movements. So the frequencies just change slightly. The reason for the shaking is to make sure that nothing's going to fall off. Because when you put your piece of equipment on the spacecraft, it's vital that nothing falls off and damages any other piece of equipment.
Are they tested individually as well as all combined together, or is it just an individual testing?
So each one of these combined FEMs were tested en bloc. We didn't test the pieces inside, but we did test each FEM separately. And incidentally, it cost us £1,000 to test each one. The vibrator that it goes on, we had to rent for a day. It looked rather funny because I think you could have put a small tractor on the vibrator, and to see our little tiny cube, which we'd had prepared so carefully over the previous months and years, to put it on this vibrator. But of course, worse was to come. We were to stick it on a lorry and drive it down to Laban in Italy, and then from there went to CSL in Belgium, then to S-Labs in Noordwijk in Holland, and then on an Antonov aircraft, the big Russian aircraft, and flown to Kourou in Central America, and then onto the top of the Ariane rocket and blasted into space. And all I can say is when the solid fuel rockets go off on the Ariane, it's rather similar to the space shuttle. It's just like an explosion. And the thing was blasted a million miles away. And even to this day, I still find it amazing to think that it all worked after everything that was done to these poor little things, which were like little jewels to us.
Because they're about 5 centimetres by about 3 centimetres?
Yes, it's like 2 Swan Vesta boxes of matches, isn't it? That's about
what it's like. They're not very big.
The thing I'm holding is quite heavy because it's made of brass and then it's gold-plated. What we actually flew was made of aluminium. One of the problems is you can't gold-plate aluminium, but we discovered you can nickel-plate it, and then after nickel-plating you can gold-plate it. So you had to have a multiple coating system. I used to have nightmares about space qualification. But having said all that, all this process of space qualification, and I did say a bit of luck, has resulted in the machine all operate, all of it worked, all the bits that we built, and they're all still working as I speak now.
Was there any other thing that you were building beyond these that you're holding now?
Oh, well, it's this, what I hold here, is one of the amplifiers. And the amplifiers have got 2 sides. The actual RF side, the radio frequency side. So this is the 30 gigahertz amplifier. And one end, the signals go in and they come out the other end. And there's a line, a transmission line through the middle. And you can see where the 4 transistors would fit. And then on the back is all the circuitry associated with the biases, the DC voltages, if you like, what your batteries would deliver if this was a transistor amplifier of your own. And the wiring is all done with bond wires, which are little gold wires that are thinner than a human hair. And they are attached to the reason, now you might be able to explain why we need these surfaces gold plated, because the bond wires are attached to everything because it's gold to gold. And what happens is you melt the gold into the other gold and the two regions fuse together. It's called bonding. And you bond by heat and by pressure. Now, the pressure is somewhat hair-raising. It turns out the pressure is about one oil tanker per cubic meter. An oil tanker weighs about 100,000 tons. I used to joke with Eddie that was the load that he was applying. So that the tip of this bonding probe that was used here was only a few microns across. And so although it's exerting a pressure of 100,000 tons per square meter, that pressure, the actual weight, if you like, on the tip was only 6 grams. But that was equivalent to a pressure. But that was sufficient to melt the gold wire into the gold. And that was the quality of that melt was all important. That was the thing that determined whether the bond wires would stay on or fall off.
And it seems like you've done a very good job with everything.
Well, I think it was my team of technicians and engineers. I was the one who went out and got the grant. As I say, I did do the job of checking all the bond wires. And you can work it out yourself, there are 200 bond wires on the back and there are 200 bond wires on the front. So that makes 400 bond wires in each amplifier, and there are 20 amplifiers. And I think if you multiply 400 by 20, you get 8,000. So that's my calculation of 8,000 bond wires.
Wow, and they're so tiny to check everything.
Well, the transistors themselves are invisible. And I don't know how Eddie did it. If they were in a gel pack, and if you held up the gel pack to a bright light, you could just see them as, in each, there were little 2 millimetre squares. And in the middle of each 2 metre square, if you held them up to the light, you could just see a tiny fleck of gold. And that tiny fleck of gold was the transistor. And Eddie could pick those up with a pair of tweezers and carry them across and glue them into the circuit. And this tiny fleck that you could barely see had got something like 10 pads on it, 10 connections. And he could then bond wires to these 10 pads under a microscope by hand. He was bonding the wires by hand onto the transistor. Yes, it's a dark art being able to put these things together. But you see now why I was so worried about losing some of these. We've never actually lost a bond wire on any of these amplifiers. We did lose them in the early days. What we had to do was do what we called a docket. So before we started bonding, Eddie would bond some wires to a surface of gold, and then he'd pull them off. And he would measure the force that he needed to pull the wires off. And they all had to meet this level. So he would check that his bonder was working properly by doing this docket, pulling them off, check they were okay. Then he'd do his bonding, and then he'd do another docket. He had to test the bonder before he started bonding, do the bonding, and then test the bonder after and check that it was still performing just the same. So in that way, we were confident that the wires that had been bonded would stay on.
Well, thank you very much for showing me that, the test modules. It's excellent and really fascinating. And very scary that you're still kind of plugged up to the mains.
I think I'll switch myself off.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to finding out the results from Planck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Libby. For our main interview this episode, Mark talked to Dr. Paddy Leahy from here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics about some of Planck's new results.
Well, it's the day of the release of the Planck results, long awaited, and I'm talking to Dr. Paddy Leahy about those results. He works here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics and has been involved with analysing the data from Planck. So, Paddy, I thought I'd just first ask you, what is it that Planck is actually measuring?
So it's measuring the light from the Big Bang itself, which has now been redshifted so that it's at radio waves or microwaves, wavelengths from around a millimetre, but Planck measures from 1 centimetre to about a third of a millimetre.
And that light from the Big Bang, how is it that we can see that now?
Well, it's simply been travelling through the universe, which effectively is transparent for the whole history of the universe, the last 13.5 billion years. I now have to say 13.8 billion years. we pick it up with our radio receivers on the Planck satellite.
So we've got this sort of radiation streaming past us all the time, but essentially emitted at almost the same moment in the universe's history.
That's right. In a rather narrow range of times, about 380,000 years, just after the Big Bang itself, the universe rapidly became transparent. Up to that point, the photons had just been bouncing around at random, rapidly bouncing off electrons, which are scattered through the universe. But at that point, the electrons all joined up with protons to make hydrogen atoms. And since then, those electrons have been moving in random directions, so we just see the ones that happen to be heading towards Earth from their point of origin in a huge sphere, radius almost the same as the universe, which is what we see as the microwave background surrounding us.
Right. So this was quite an astonishing discovery. I know when it was first measured by, was it Penzias and Wilson who found it, and they were concerned it might have been bird droppings on their receiver or something.
They found an unexpected noise in their telescope at Bell Telephone Labs, one of the several great discoveries that laboratory has made. But in fact, it was quite a strong signal by the standards of the time. It's just no one in the business of making these accurate radio measurements expected to see it. Not so far away, there were people who'd been predicting it, but didn't expect anybody to be able to measure it. So. Yeah. Putting the two together was a great discovery, really.
So since then, people have been measuring it ever more accurately. So can you tell us why the Planck spacecraft was sent out there to do these more accurate measurements?
Well, Planck was designed in the early 90s in the immediate aftermath of the first successful microwave background satellite, which was COBE, which actually proved beyond all doubt that the radiation came from the Big Bang, had a perfect black body temperature spectrum, and detected also for the first time fluctuations in the temperature, which were due to the seeds of the structure which forms galaxies. So if the universe had been perfectly uniform, galaxies would never have been able to collapse because every atom would be pulled equally in all directions, and so it wouldn't fall into any particular point to make a star or a galaxy. So we knew the universe had to be slightly irregular very early on, and that should be reflected in the microwave background. Apparently, its brightness being varying slightly from point to point on the sky. So COBE discovered that, but very crudely. And the race was then on to measure that precisely, and there was a whole range of experiments on the ground and in space designed to follow that up. So the American WMAP satellite got up there first and produced some very nice results. But Planck goes beyond WMAP in many ways. In particular, our best channels are many times more sensitive than WMAP, which allows us to measure these temperature fluctuations at a very low level. Very small fluctuations are accessible to Planck. And we can also see smaller physical fluctuations on the sky than WMAP can.
So I'm thinking now of what we'll probably link to in the show notes, which is this map of the sky that's a kind of patchwork of sort of reds and greens and blues, and those are the different temperatures that we see for the CMB.
Right.
That's not exactly random, but it's sort of the seeds of our own universe as it is today.
Well, yeah, one of the big questions is just how random it is. And we've done part of the analysis from our group is to look at all the tests to see whether, for instance, there's statistically it's the same in all directions on the sky, whether the size of the fluctuations is predicted by what's called the Gaussian probability distribution. The basic theory of how structure originates in the universe, which is the inflationary theory, predicts that both that statistically it should be isotropic and it should be Gaussian. What we actually find is it's very close to Gaussian. We can't measure any non-Gaussian signature in it at all. There are hints of anisotropy, that is, being different in different directions, more fluctuations on one side of the sky than the other, for instance. They're there in the data, but it's not entirely clear whether that's not just the sort of level of anisotropy you would expect at random.
Right, so there could just be a random feature of our particular universe,
yeah.
And so when we're measuring those anisotropies, which means the distribution of these patches of different temperature, it's been made into a graph where you've got power on one axis, and then you've got this thing called multipole on the other axis, and you've sort of got this wavy line with about 8 bumps in it.
Yes.
And can you tell us about what the multipole means and what it's telling us there?
Well, let's say a monopole would be something that's the same all over the sky. A dipole is hotter on one side of the sky than the other. The next one up is actually the quadrupole, which has 2 hot patches and 2 cold patches at right angles to it, and so on. Octopole is the one after that. You get more and more complexity.
Splitting it into smaller and smaller
so
patches.
So yeah. It's the equivalent of analysing the sky to a technique that's often used by engineers to look at time series, which is called Fourier analysis. So say if you took the sound waves that we're making now and put them through a spectrometer, you would see certain frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So what the equivalent of a frequency in a sound wave is a multipole as a distribution of bright and dark spots on the sky.
So sort of larger patches or smaller patches,
exactly.
And how many of those there?
So the higher the multipole, the smaller the typical patch size is.
But the amazing thing with Planck is that we had these data points tracing out exactly the bumps that were predicted by the cosmological models. So can you talk about how that model predicts those results?
Well, yes. with great mathematical subtlety is one way of answering it. So the theory of inflation predicts that you, not on the sky, but in space, you get ripples, literally, which are waves, it predicts that, you know, if you measure the amplitude of those waves in a certain way, irrespective of the wavelengths, you get the same amount of power, mm-hmm. so-called scale-free spectrum. You then have to translate that as into what you would actually see on the sky. That will give you a very bland sky with no particular peaks on the diagram you're talking about. But then you have to allow for the way the universe evolves in time in its first 380,000 years before the photons are released. And the beginnings of the gravitational clumping that go on to make galaxies work better at some scales, some physical sizes than others. And that translates into higher or lower amplitudes for certain multipoles on the sky. So certain spot sizes turn out to be amplified, so we see brighter and darker patches at that scale. Other spot sizes are de-amplified, so we see much less fluctuations on those scales. And the graph you're talking about shows that this set of fluctuations where some scales get extra, some less, goes on for a whole series of 8 different scales that we can directly measure, from about 1 degree on the sky down to about 5 minutes of arc is the level we've got to.
Okay, so it's really constraining our models of the universe. So maybe what I get onto next, at the risk of this sounding a bit like a budget by a chancellor, is some of the headline numbers that came out of Planck, because it's been able to help us constrain some of the sort of important numbers about our universe, like the age and how fast it's expanding and how much dark matter and dark energy we think there is, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, and that's the name of the game in this business. So, of course, every previous experiment has also measured these numbers. And in a sense, the headline from Planck is that nothing was wrong, that the picture, our basic picture of the universe, despite the fact that Planck data is really vastly better than anything that's come before, hasn't changed. Some of the numbers have moved a little bit, so it seems that the universe is expanding slightly more slowly than we thought before. So the famous Hubble constant, Planck is measuring at about 68, whereas the Space Telescope measurements are coming in about 74, a discrepancy which is, you know, sort of about a 1% chance that those two numbers would be that far apart just by chance. It's quite a lot bit better than the situation we were when I started my career, where there were people saying the number was 50 and there were people saying no, it had to be more than 100. So they couldn't agree to within a factor of 2. And we're now agreeing to within about 5%. But apparently a discrepancy nevertheless.
And that number, just to sort of clarify for people, that means if you go another megaparsec away in the universe, which is a sort of about 3 million light years or so, then things should be expanding away from you at about 67 kilometers per second faster.
That's right.
Which is quite fast.
There are a lot of megaparsecs in the universe, so by the time you get 3/4 of the way across the universe, things are actually moving away from you at the speed of light. That's what I call fast.
And then there was the age of the universe, which I've often had it sort of quoted as 13.7 billion years.
So at that point... essentially, we agree within the error bars. Our new number is 13.8, plus or minus 0.06, so very, very close to the previous value. And it turns out that that number is one of the ones that's really sharply pinned down by just measuring a few of these peaks in the angular power spectrum that you were describing earlier.
Right, so that's one of the sort of robust numbers.
Exactly.
And then we had the amount of dark energy and the amount of dark matter and the amount of normal baryonic matter, as they call it, which is what we're made of. And they were saying during the press conference that before Planck's results, we had something like 73% dark energy as a fraction of the universe's energy. 23% was dark matter and about 4.5% was supposed to be normal matter, such as we're made of. And what have we got now?
So it's now about 69% dark energy, which is essentially what's left over when you take... Let me rephrase this. These percentages are based on the idea that the universe has just precisely got the amount of energy in it that it will expand forever, the so-called flat space, which means that Euclidean geometry applies on a large scale. Mm-hmm. So one of the big questions in cosmology has always been whether the universe is curved, and whether, for instance, if it was positively curved, that means if you travel outwards in a straight line for the history of the universe or something, you might come back to the place you originally started, like going around, so walking north on a planet, you just keep walking, you eventually get back to where you started. And Planck is showing, really for the first time from a pure CMB experiment, the universe is almost exactly flat. So if you add up the different components using this parameterization, they come to one, which is what you need for a flat universe. So of that, the stuff that we can easily detect is matter, which we detect by its gravitational effect. And for that, we've got about 31% of the total energy density you need to make the universe flat is matter.
So that's including dark matter.
That's dark matter and ordinary so-called baryonic matter, the stuff we're made of. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it, the 69%, is the dark energy, which is you need to make up the difference.
Which is causing the, as far as you can tell, the expansion.
To have accelerating expansion, you need dark energy. The universe would expand quite happily if there was none of that in it, but it would be gradually slowing down. In fact, it's speeding up, and that's the signature of that.
And there was one other number which was quite interesting, because I noticed that even among the physicists in the audience, it stumped a few people, and it was a number that was referred to as the slope of the primordial spectrum. And it was a number that was measured to be around about 0.96, and the interesting thing was that it was not 1.
Exactly.
So what did that mean?
So before gravity starts working on this, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, at the very beginning of the universe, inflation creates structure, and it creates it essentially equally on all scales. In fact, the way it creates it is very interesting. It is literally due to quantum fluctuations. So the very largest scale things we can see in the universe are caused by quantum fluctuations on a tiny atomic scale, but they've been blown up to enormous size by this inflationary period at the beginning of the universe. So inflation expands and expands the universe at an ever-accelerating rate exponentially, in fact. And that means that the earlier in that inflationary period you get, the bigger the structure has been blown up to. So this inflationary period which came to an end. The way it works is that since structure is generated by these quantum fluctuations, which are happening the same way all the time, but the earlier ones have been blown up bigger,
right,
you get fluctuation power distributed over a range of physical scale size from gigaparsecs down through megaparsecs to the size of stars and eventually down to atoms. And if it is distributed in effectively equal power on all those scales, we say the slope n is 1. So one of the strong predictions of inflation was that this slope should be pretty close to 1, but not exactly, because that's what you would get if inflation was still going on now.
Right.
And it had to stop, otherwise nothing would be able to collapse and form galaxies and so on. So when inflation comes to a halt, that changes the distribution of power very slightly on scales that we're interested in, that we can actually see in the sky. So the prediction is actually different models could give you numbers which are different from 1 on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite significant that it's less than 1, because that rules out a whole bunch of inflationary models. Inflation isn't so much a theory as a kind of theory, and the thousands literally of inflationary theories, which are very hard to tell apart, but we've got rid of about half of them,
right,
with this clear measurement. To be fair, the WMAP probe had also indicated NS less than 1, but not to such undeniable statistical significance.
Right, okay. So it actually sort of helps to try and constrain this slightly mysterious inflation. The other thing I was interested in was they were talking about how this was based on the Lambda CDM cosmological model, as they call it, which is the dark energy plus cold dark matter.
That's right.
And I remember hearing Professor Carlos Frank talking a bit about how it might be difficult to say whether this dark matter was cold or whether it could be a bit warm, a little bit faster. The results from Planck, do you think they'll help people like him to constrain their models?
Well, they certainly constrain specific models of warm dark matter. Let me unwind that a bit. What we mean by cold versus warm is the speed that the particles were moving around. So cold particles are moving slowly, warm particles reasonably fast, hot particles would be moving nearly at the speed of light. No half measures in cosmology. Specifically, it's how fast these particles were moving at the time that we see the cosmic background photons released, this 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe. One way to get hot dark matter, or a fraction of hot dark matter, for instance, is to have a lot of energy in neutrinos. Cosmological theory plus particle physics theory actually tells us just how much energy we can have in neutrinos, because we think there are three different types of them. But there's always a possibility that particle physicists have got it wrong, and there are actually some neutrinos that they've missed so far, which would allow us to have more energy in neutrinos. So Planck has set an upper limit on the number of different kinds of neutrinos, which basically is the three that we know and nothing else.
Right.
So that puts a limit on the sort of how much hot dark matter, and if you think of that as a fraction of hot, a mixture of hot and cold gives you a little bit of warm matter,
right.
Then that sets a limit. Otherwise, you have to specifically say what kind of theory are you asking about with warm dark matter. For each such theory, you can predict the power spectrum of cosmic background fluctuations and see if it fits our data or not. So we've done that for a few, but not, you know, not every possible theory. That's for people who have their own theories want to try that and compare it with the data.
Right. So there's obviously still going to be a lot of people investigating these results further. So maybe as a last thing, I just thought I'd ask you about some of the Planck results that haven't come out yet and what we might expect to see. They were talking in the press conference about the polarized CMB, so the fraction of the cosmic microwave background that's actually in polarized radiation, and in particular people are trying to detect certain patterns in that. When will we sort of see those results appearing?
Certainly this time next year at the very latest. Planck has been up there running for a year and a half since the results that have been published today were collected. So today's results are based on the official mission that was authorized ahead of time before launch, which is 15 months worth of data. In fact, it's going to run for 4 years. One of the two instruments, in fact the most sensitive one, the high frequency instrument, required helium coolant, which ran out after just about 2 years and 3 months. But still, that's nearly twice as much data as we've published to date. So that extra data will help, because polarization is extremely faint. So whereas we're limited by all sorts of instrumental calibration issues and so on, basically set the limit of what we can do for the data that's published so far. For polarization, often it's just to do with we need more data just to get the noise down.
Right.
So both our calibration and the length of time is going to improve, and that should produce some very nice polarization results in due course, as I say, within a year anyway.
And what would that tell us about the cosmology that we're looking
at? Well, so there are two things. One is the sort of less spectacular one is to tell you more about what happened in the dark ages, or how long the dark ages of the universe lasted. So the dark ages are the period after the microwave background is let loose, atoms form and rapidly cool down, and you have a very boring period of the universe in which it's basically smooth hydrogen gas, a little bit of helium, nothing happening. But that's gradually, over time, the clouds are condensing and forming the first galaxies and stars. And as soon as those turn on, they start producing light, and particularly ultraviolet light, which moves out through the universe and starts stripping the electrons off the atoms again. So we call that reionization. And that's really the dawn of the modern universe consisting of stars and galaxies. We know that process finished at a redshift of about 6. So that's about 1.5 billion years after the Big Bang, something like that. But the question is, when did it start? And the polarization data can tell you that. So we've got a rough estimate from WMAP, but Planck should really nail it down. From the point of view of the professional cosmologist, that's the less interesting of the two possibilities mm-hmm. that we can do. The other is that there's a certain pattern of polarization which is only produced not after the microwave background was released, but long before, actually at the time of inflation. So it's the only signal that we're getting directly from the period where the universe inflated, which was about 10 to the minus 35 seconds
right.
after the Big Bang, a ridiculously early time. Mm-hmm. But the exact time that it happens is one of the crucial numbers we'd like to know about inflation. As I say, inflation is a bunch of theories, and one of the things that's different in different theories is the time that it happened. Mm-hmm. So the earlier it happened, the bigger this polarization effect turns out to be. It's one of the few things that if you push back in time, it becomes easier to see. So these are the infamous B-mode polarizations, which is we can pick out of the polarization by doing one of these mode analysis, a bit like the picking out the acoustic peaks. Planck already actually has put pretty good limits on that kind of thing from just from the temperature anisotropies, the temperature fluctuations that we've released today, but the polarization should be able to push that down by at least a factor of two. And obviously, we're always hoping that we'll actually detect something in that gap. Whether we do or not, we'll have to see.
Right. Well, those are very exciting results, and more to come. So thank you very much, Paddy.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for that, Mark. Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other things we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends.
I want to talk about near-Earth objects, because there seem to have been a lot of objects near the Earth recently, slightly too close for comfort in some cases. There was the meteor that exploded over Russia that I'm sure everyone heard about, not to mention the asteroid that was only something like 30,000 kilometres from the Earth quite recently. It was about 50 metres across, I think. And there's also another one called 2013 ET, and passed about 2.5 times more distant than the Moon from the Earth. So there seems to be a lot of these things about, and in view of that, NASA is setting up an experimental asteroid radar array at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It consists of 3 dishes, each 12 meters across, and they're separated by about 60 meters. So the idea with that is to get a good resolution and a really good look at asteroids and near-Earth objects. And they're going to observe at a frequency of 30 gigahertz, which is pretty high. It's higher than most radio observations, and it's a wavelength of about 1 centimetre. And that frequency is called Ka band. So they've called the instrument the Ka band Object Observation and Monitoring Project, or KABOOM for short. So that's obviously what they're trying to avoid on the Earth. Again, the idea of using a high frequency is to get a better resolution, and it is a radar array, so they're actually going to be sending out radio waves and then collecting the echoes that come back off asteroids. Now, it's not actually really going to be a detector, because it's not going to look at the whole sky all the time, which I think it would be the job of another instrument, but it can then follow up on an asteroid, and it can tell us things like the size and the shape and hopefully the composition of asteroids better than can be currently done by, for example, NASA's Goldstone antenna, which is a 70-meter dish. And with that one, they talk about detecting or observing near-Earth objects out to about 0.1 astronomical units, which is a tenth of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And with the KABOOM, they're talking about looking out to 1 astronomical unit, or about 93 million miles from the Earth. So hopefully getting a really good idea of what's out there, and so we don't get any more of these things sneaking up on us.
So it'll put all the doomsday soothsayers out of a job then.
Hopefully. Or maybe into a job if they find something that's coming towards us. But hopefully by knowing more about these objects, we'll have a better chance of moving them out of the way, which again is something in the slightly further future, but that would be ultimately what people would have to think about.
Right, well, fascinating and slightly terrifying stuff there from Mark. Actually, I'm going to talk about something that, going from near-Earth objects to things that are on the Earth, strange enough for astrophysics, because a group of scientists at the University of Surrey have managed to mimic conditions in type of stars known as white dwarfs right here on Earth in a lab. Now, the Sun, and most other stars in the galaxy is going to end up one day as a white dwarf. So these are sort of dying stars made up of a dim and fading core. They're about the size of the Earth, but they pack in something like 40 to 90% of the sun's mass, so they're extremely dense objects. And they actually they present a very, very strong magnetic field, which is about 100,000 Teslas. This is, I think, something like a trillion times larger than the Earth's magnetic field. So incredibly strong field that we have no chance of recreating on Earth. In fact, the highest fields we've created on Earth are about only 1,000 Teslas. Nevertheless, scientists have managed to mimic these conditions using crystalline silicon, which they've sprinkled with phosphorus atoms. And this structure mimics a hydrogen atom because there's sort of one proton and one electron that sort of pair up within the crystal. And it turns out that if you apply reasonably strong magnetic fields of about 30 Tesla, the differences in size and properties like the dielectric constant actually mean that you get a very similar behavior from these so-called fake hydrogen atoms to that you get within a 100,000 Tesla white dwarf. So, incredibly enough, they've managed to bring this really exotic behavior that's only been seen in spectral lines and observations of distant white dwarfs. They've managed to bring that right down into the lab. So it's something of a first for astrophysics.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. Really amazing.
And have they been able to find out anything that might apply to the physics of white dwarfs that we sort of didn't know before?
Well, they'll definitely be able to study the properties of or the behavior of these atoms, these hydrogen atoms, under these really strong magnetic fields, and maybe figure out something about what's going on in the white dwarfs themselves, drawing parallels between what they can see in their labs. And also, there has been suspected that there are more exotic molecular compounds that form in white dwarfs due to the intense magnetic fields, such as helium-2. Which isn't seen at all. And their next step is to try and mimic some of these, so helium, and whether it can form interesting bonds, and then apply the same lowish magnetic field, but then recreate the conditions that are within the white dwarfs.
I'm hoping one day they might recreate a neutron star, or a bit of a neutron star on Earth, maybe.
Or maybe a black hole.
Star, or a black yeah, watch out for creating black holes.
More doomsday stuff from the Jodcast there.
Yay. Right, so I'm going to talk about something miles and miles and miles away from here, like get out of the Earth and the solar system and the galaxy. So this is the first detection of the furthest or the most distant galaxy ever observed. And this was observed with ALMA. So I just wanted to say that this is probably my last presenting episode in the Jodcast, and I'm going to work for ALMA in about a week and a half. So I thought it was appropriate to take to have an ALMA news. And ALMA is just having news every week, so pretty much, yeah, it was easy to find a news. So if you, maybe you heard about this, so the inauguration of ALMA was on the 13th of March, and it already started observing about a year and a half ago. So with 16 antennas, they detected two galaxies, which are the most distant of the kind ever seen. And amazingly, they not only break the distance astronomical records, but they also observe water molecules on these galaxies. So these are two star-forming galaxies. And also the most important thing that they found is that models, before these observations, they thought that galaxies start forming about 5 billion years after the Big Bang. But these distant galaxies, because you can measure the distance, you can kind of know where they are, when are they formed. And they said that these galaxies, they're just under 2 billion years old after the Big Bang. So these changes our predictions. So these galaxies are forming before we thought. So that's also pretty interesting. What are they doing now is they're actually looking into 26 galaxies at a wavelength of 3 millimeters, roughly, which is this ALMA observes in a millimeter. And they only need to observe these galaxies a few minutes. This is about 100 times faster than it has been done before, which is pretty amazing. And this is only with 16 antennas, so ALMA is going to be 66 So you can imagine that in about a year, you can observe a galaxy in probably seconds or microseconds or something, which is pretty amazing, yeah. At the moment, they're observing pretty bright galaxies, but they're planning on once the whole array is formed with 66 antennas, they can go in to find very dim and faint galaxies that could be observed due to gravitational lensing. So this is like a follow-up project.
So why is ALMA good for water and for looking at starburst galaxies?
So in the millimeter wavelength or regime, most of the molecules are made on the millimeter regime. And funny enough, water is everywhere. So you find water in every single thing that you look at. And this is one of the reasons that why ALMA needed to be really high up on the mountains, because the telescopes are 5,000 meters up. And this is because they want to avoid all the water in the atmosphere. So you get rid of the water in the atmosphere and you only have a very few. And then when you observe, you don't have any interference from the atmosphere. I mean, probably the best thing we'll have to have satellites, right? But away from outside the Earth, but that's way too expensive, I guess. Yeah. In the millimeter, you detect a lot of molecules. And this is why you can observe water.
And the star formation, is that also easily observed?
So the star formation, yeah, so these galaxies are pretty young, so they're forming new stars. And you see this because you see a lot, so on the spectra, you see a lot of blue stars. So that means that it's forming new stars, yeah. If you see a lot of red stars or not many blue stars, then it could be an elliptical galaxy or an older galaxy.
Great. So that's some really promising observations coming from the Atacama Desert and ALMA.
And now from galaxies making stars to a star in the making, Dr. Ian McDonald answers your astronomical questions.
Hi. We have three questions today. So we're going to start with Mick Carling, that's saying, my son Ben suddenly came out with, Dad, is it never a true full moon because the sun will have to be directly behind you and then the moon will be in shadow? Thinking about it, I cannot follow his logic. Is it true?
Yes, it's true. It's what we call a lunar eclipse, and there's one happening next month. Most people are familiar with the fact that solar eclipses happen when the moon comes in front of the sun, as seen from the Earth. The Earth can also come in front of the sun, as seen from the moon. Now, this doesn't happen every month because the moon's orbit is tilted slightly, by about 5 degrees, to the Earth's orbit around the sun. But every now and again they can come into alignment, and the moon passes through the Earth's shadow. Now, if you're in Europe and have clear skies in the evening of Thursday, the 25th of April, have a look out to the east. The moon will rise at sunset, just before 9 p.m. British Summer Time. It'll be maximum eclipse at that time, and will look like it's had a big chunk taken out of it where the Earth's shadow lies. And over the next couple of hours, the moon will slowly pass out of the Earth's shadow and regain its normal full brightness. If you're living in the UK and want to see a total lunar eclipse, where the entire moon disappears behind the Earth's shadow, you're going to have to wait until the early morning of the 28th of September 2015. Lunar eclipses can be quite spectacular, and can sometimes even turn the moon blood red. But that depends on exactly how the light from the sun is refracted through the Earth's atmosphere. But I don't want to wait that long, so I'm going to hope for clear skies on April the 25th.
Pretty good. The next question is from Henry Marston, and he's asking, as the International Space Station interacts with the thin atmosphere where it orbits, it slows down and loses altitude. Every so often, rocket's power has to be used to rise it to a higher orbit. On the other hand, the moon is moving away at its orbits. Orbital energy is used to rise tides on Earth. Why does the moon move outwards, but artificial satellites move inward?
Well, Henry's actually answered his own question there. The ISS is dragged into the atmosphere, whereas the moon moves outwards because it's using up its orbital energy raising tides on Earth. These are two fundamentally different processes, and they operate at different altitudes to different bodies. But let's look at this a little closer. Let's take atmospheric drag, for example. The further away from Earth you go, the thinner the atmosphere gets, the less drag you experience. If you can get high enough, the atmosphere peters out and you have no drag. You can go into orbit forever. The ISS and other low-orbit satellites are positioned just inside the point at which atmospheric drag becomes important. Now, that's a trade-off between the expense needed to launch things to higher orbits and the time that they can survive in lower orbits without being dragged into the atmosphere. But if you go a little higher than low Earth orbit, atmospheric drag stops becoming important. Now, once you can ignore atmospheric drag, things become a lot simpler. Whether something moves inwards or outwards is controlled by the tides. Then it all depends on whether the orbiting satellite is going around faster or slower than the Earth spins. If a satellite is in a low orbit, orbiting faster than the Earth spins, then the bulge caused by the tide it exerts on the Earth will tend to drag the satellite back and it will lose energy and spiral in. However, if a satellite is in a high orbit, like the Moon, which orbits slower than the Earth spins, then the tidal bulge will rotate ahead of the satellite and will be pulled forwards, giving it energy and making it spiral away from the Earth. Of course, this also depends on the mass of the satellite, because that controls the size of the tidal bulge it creates. The effect on tiny man-made satellites is negligible. It would take more than the lifetime of the universe for them to spiral into the Earth via tidal forces alone. But if you've got something as big as the Moon, which can create rather larger tides, then it can travel much faster. The Moon, for example, is moving away from the Earth at 3.8 centimetres per year. Now, the other interesting thing is the effect this has on the Earth. The energy that goes into pushing the Moon away has to come from somewhere, and that somewhere is the Earth's rotation. Pushing the Moon away has caused the Earth to slow down. If you were here a few billion years ago, you might have noticed that the day was only about 20 hours long. It's increased to the 24 hours a day we have at present over that time. And it continues to change, not only due to the Moon's influence, but by whether our water is concentrated as ice at the poles or water at the equator. Even major earthquakes and weather systems can measurably affect the length of the day by a few microseconds. Henry's final comment, which we didn't include here, asks how this applies to exoplanets. The same principle can occur here. Well, migrations of planets in these conditions are also controlled by factors during their formation. Everything from viscous drag in the planetary disks to gravitational interactions between neighbouring planets. All these things come into play here. Tidal forces are important in making the closest in planets spiral into their stars. But that can't explain how they got there in the first place. But that's a whole other question for another time.
Okay, and the third question from John Bordelon says, watching for meteors, I noticed several flashes in the sky. I have seen these in many locales many times while watching the night sky. These points of light do not return in the same spot. What am I seeing?
Good question. We don't know. Every now and again we get legitimate questions from very clever people saying they've said something in the sky. What is it? Well, the truth is that the sky is a big and exciting place, in which many things go on. And a written description isn't usually enough to tell what they are, even a very precise one. Often it's confounded by the fact that people say, oh, it was about the size of an elephant, when, because you don't know how far away it is, you don't know how big it is. It could easily have been the size of a pea or the size of a star. The fact of the matter is that our brains and eyes are better designed to find nutritious roots and beasts on the Serengeti than to critically analysing things in the night sky. Now, there are a lot of things that could produce the momentary flashes in the sky that John sees. I've seen some myself. I don't know what they were. A few things that could produce flashes in various guises can be aeroplanes, iridium flare satellites, and meteors. But most seasoned observers can identify these almost all of the time. John isn't the only person to have reported seeing flashes like these, though. But without further details, it's hard to know what's going on. For example, astronauts report seeing similar flashes, which are caused by high-energy particles decaying inside their eyeballs. Now, the Earth's magnetic field protects us from most of these particles on the surface, but not all of them. You can see them on long camera exposures, for example. But particles with energies high enough to punch through the atmosphere tend to get through a lot of other things too. So if John's flashes are caused by decaying high-energy particles, he should still be able to see them when he's in a darkened room. Of course, if you're seeing random flashes, it could just be fundamental damage to your optic nerve, in which case you should go and see a doctor. They'll probably most likely tell you that they don't know what it is either.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Ian and Liz. Now we move on to your feedback. And we've had a lovely postcard from Jen Gupta down in Portsmouth at the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation. And it shows a barred spiral galaxy that was taken with the dark energy camera. So Jen thinks she'd like our new postcards, and she misses us. So I'm assuming that means the listeners rather than the presenters.
Well, I miss Jen.
Yeah, I'm sure people will remember that Jen was one of the presenters, and now I think she's just showing off about her new job down in Portsmouth.
Brilliant. So on the email, we got thank you all for your Ask an Astronomer questions. And on forum, we thank Mark C. and Joey O. 9292 for posting.
On Facebook, Tony Angel posted a photograph of Comet Pan-STARRS that he took from the SON Observatory in Granada in Spain. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It could be the SON Observatory. I'm not sure. But that's brilliant because I went to look for Comet Pan-STARRS and I couldn't find it with my telescope. So well done for taking that nice photograph. You can see the coma and everything.
Nice.
And on Twitter, thanks for the retweets and the follow Fridays.
And if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send us posts, the address is on the website. Thanks to Richard Davis and Paddy Leahy for the interviews. The editors were Dan Thornton, Liz Guzman and Mark Perver, and the producer was Dan Thornton. Till next time, jod on!